College in Minnesota, at 6:30 at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. On Saturday, we're out to Madison, Wisconsin in the afternoon, then Chicago in the evening. Sunday, I'm speaking in Michigan, Kalamazoo at 11, Lansing at 2, and Grand Rapids at 5:30. Monday night, I'll be speaking in Philadelphia at the Philly Free Library. Check our website for details. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gezder, Nirmi Che, Carla Wisler, Augustino, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Jenna here from Pacific Underground, the show where Asians and Pacific Islanders tell our stories and unpack the issues impacting our communities. Tune in this Friday, May 5th at 9 a.m., where we're going to be talking about how the month of May is Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. While having an entire month is exciting for some, it's a complete eye roll for others. So tune in this Friday to hear the Pacific Underground crew unpack the complexity of the terms Asian and Pacific Islander and debate the benefits of having a Heritage Month all to ourselves. I personally could do without it. Again, that's Pacific Underground this Friday, May 5th at 9 a.m. right here on 90.7 FM KBOO, your community radio station.
You're listening to KBO Portland.
The time is now 5 p.m. It's time for your evening news. And this program is made possible by KBOO members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting the Django Festival All-Stars on Thursday, June 15th at the Winningstad Theater. This group of hot jazz swing musicians from Europe carry on the legacy of guitarist Django Reinhardt. Tickets for this all-ages event on June 15th with the Django Festival All-Stars are available now at portland5.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland protesters get varying responses from the Portland Police Bureau.
Gregory McKelvey of Portland's Resistance talks about protest permits.
And the U.S. is sending a 750-truck convoy of military supplies to the West Coast.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jasmine. Deaths from opioid abuse have reached an all-time high across the nation. KBOO's Ricky King, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, has more.
As the opioid crisis continues to haunt the country, communities are looking for ways to fight back. Opioids cause about 91 deaths a day in the United States and resulted in a historic high 33,000 deaths in 2015. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that that number actually could be an underestimation. In Oregon, the rate of opioid deaths is higher than the national average. Dr. Safina Qureshi, medical director at Columbia Pacific CCO, says it's even worse for the North Coast where she works. She says that trust among community members can be a useful prevention tool since addiction doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Talking about within the community how trauma can affect all of this, and that is something that we've been working with our community, and our community within the North Coast is really passionate about and has been struggling with and moving forward regarding what does community resilience mean and how can we collectively build that.
Last month, the federal government distributed money to states to help fight opioid abuse, including $6.5 million for Oregon as part of the 21st Century Cures Act. Some members of Congress have argued the legislation does not provide nearly enough to fight the crisis. Qureshi says there are many facets to fighting the epidemic, the best tool being education. She says opioids should not be the first choice for treating chronic pain and that it's important for medical professionals to know this. For instance, getting better sleep may be a more effective tool for treating pain. And Qureshi says it's imperative to get more pills off the street.
We've funded and helped the community start drug take-back boxes within pharmacies so it's easier for people to give back unused pills.
Qureshi believes we're in the midst of a huge societal paradigm shift on these drugs, but she isn't sure we've reached the tipping point yet. She says everybody has to help to stop the staggering amount of destruction opioid abuse has wreaked on the country.
It's everybody's responsibility to get us out of this. And I literally think every single person within society plays a role in in addressing this, just like in addressing any other major complex societal issue.
For the KABU Evening News and Oregon News Service, I'm Ricky King.
Portland had the dubious honor of making national headlines when the 82nd Avenue of the Roses parade had to be canceled due to an anonymous email. The email threatened a confrontation between right-wing white supremacists and anti-fascists. Fearing violence, parade organizers felt they had no choice but to cancel the event. Like many Portlanders, KBOO's Ray Bodwell was disappointed to learn of the cancellation and has a few thoughts.
Unidentified anti-fascists have been blamed for sending the threatening email that ultimately led to the cancellation of last Saturday's 82nd Avenue of the Roses parade. They had heard that white supremacists and Nazis from groups such as the Bible Believers and Joey Gibson's Patriot Prayer were planning to infiltrate the parade and march along with the Multnomah County Republican Party, and stated that, quote, "We will not give one inch to groups who espouse hatred towards LGBT, immigrants, people of color, or others," end quote. Certainly an admirable position. They then apparently demanded that the parade organizers give the Republicans the boot, a demand that they said was, quote, "non-negotiable." The Republicans, scheduled to march in the 67th position of the parade, vehemently denied that they were hosting Nazis and refused to withdraw. They commented that anyone who thinks they would tolerate marching in a parade with folks carrying swastikas was, quote, "delusional." After that, the rhetoric from both the white supremacists and the anti-fascist groups continued to escalate to the point where parade organizers had no choice but to pull the plug on what would have been the parade's 11th year. I find this situation infuriating. As a white male baby boomer, I know that I have had a privileged existence. I can't really know the fear, anger, and frustration that marginalized people or groups that have faced institutionalized discrimination know. I can only sympathize and promise that for my part, I will not further contribute to that discrimination. I also know that groups like the Bible Believers and people like Joey Gibson or Alan Wesley Puckett are revolting hate mongers that represent some of the worst that humanity has to offer. Unfortunately, I also know that when anti-fascists threaten physical violence to stop those people from participating in the parade, they sacrificed the moral high ground and brought themselves down to the level of the very people they despise. Rather than lead by example, like the 300 people in February that formed a human shield to protect parishioners of St. Peter's Catholic Church from the vile taunts of the Bible Believers, the anti-fascists demonstrated the same political intolerance that has long been associated with the extreme right wing, and more recently, our current president. Here are a couple of questions that I think we should all be asking ourselves. Did shutting down Portland City Council meetings nearly every Wednesday for 2 months, while labeling the council and Portland Police Bureau as terrorist organizations, in any way aid in the search for a solution to homelessness or police brutality, or did it just generate public sympathy for the very organizations that so frustrated those protesters? The threats that resulted in the cancellation of the 82nd Avenue Rose Parade not only stopped potential Nazi or white supremacist hate speech, it may have also prevented a message of love or tolerance from any one of the more than 60 other groups that were registered to march. Would it not have been a more effective and visible message if protesters had simply turned their backs or showed some other obvious signs of disagreement as the offending marchers trudged past? Shouting down bigots will not cause them to renounce their bigotry. It will only solidify their beliefs and allow them to play the role of a martyr. And though I've probably never supported any Republican policy in my life, I agree with their refusal to withdraw from the 82nd Avenue parade. Because like it or not, as long as it's not an incitement to violence or other illegal activity, the First Amendment guarantees everyone the right of free speech, even when it's disagreeable, hateful, or hurtful. Shutting off another's right to free speech because you disagree with their politics, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, neocon or anarchist, alt-right or communist, or yes, even a Nazi white supremacist, simply makes you a tyrant, And isn't tyranny what we're all supposed to be fighting against? For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Portland's May Day march yesterday became a stage for police to confront anarchists from a group known as the Black Bloc. Police had issued permits for the march, and the peaceful noon gathering of roughly 2,000 included the full spectrum of Portland activists, from anarchists to Quakers and Cascadian separatists. At around 4:20 p.m., the police suddenly pulled the event permit, quote, based on the violence of the crowd, end quote. Black Bloc participants had thrown smoke bombs and Pepsi cans at police dressed in full riot gear. Someone broke a window of the downtown federal courthouse. Protesters burned newspapers and traffic cones in the street, and there was minor damage at the Church of Scientology and the Nines Hotel. While the police bureau called the protest a riot, the violence did not seem to meet that standard. Police contended that there were Molotov cocktails used, although KBOO reporters and other press on the scene saw no indication of this. KBOO tried to reach Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler for comment on police reaction at the event and the use of the term riot. Mayor Wheeler had praised police restraint in light of what he called, quote, very dangerous circumstances, end quote, but we have not heard back.
The Portland Police Bureau is coming under heavy criticism after revoking the permit for yesterday's May Day rally. The rally was quickly declared a riot, with the police responding with tear gas and rushing the crowds, which included families and children. KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama spoke with Gregory McKelvey of Portland's Resistance to get his take on the police response and Mayor Ted Wheeler's recent statement, which praises the Portland police's actions as, quote, tremendous.
So, you know, every time that we had a protest and it was non-permitted, one of the major excuses for why there would be violence at the hands of the police was because we failed to get a permit. So a lot of people decided, well, maybe it would be better to pay the fee and get a permit, let the police know the march route. And we realized that, you know, police can't help themselves from committing violence at a protest. The only thing that getting a permit does is you give them the march route and they know where to cut you off and hurt you. So I don't see any benefit at this point to getting a permit. It doesn't shield you. I mean, we thought that it was somewhat of an extortion to where it would shield you from police violence, but it's clear that they can't help themselves.
So at yesterday's rally, you know, there was lots of different media reports about what supposedly this violence was that was being reported by the police, the reasons that they decided to pull the permit and declare the area a riot. As somebody who was actually at the protest, you know, did you witness what they were claiming were Molotov cocktails and this level of violence that seems very escalated in their language?
I mean, there was absolutely no Molotov cocktails. That's ridiculous. I don't even know where they get that from. I've never at a protest seen that happen. I feel like if you're going to make something up, at least make something that's a little more believable up, unless, you know, they consider a Pepsi can that's handed to them to be a Molotov cocktail. I'm not sure. But no, I didn't see Molotov cocktails. You know, I don't think that every single protester acted, you know, in a way that maybe I would or that the community wants protests to go. But I can say that the violence kicked off at the hands of the police at the back of the march. And even if there had been one person that did something, you know, illegal, it doesn't make sense to then throw everybody's safety into jeopardy because of one individual to yank the permit. Nobody in the front of the march could hear that the permit was taken away and that the march was canceled. So then you have police trying to storm through a crowd where the back of the crowd is the people that they think they have the authority to hurt because they're wearing black. But in more in the front of the march, you have women, children, et cetera, dogs. And so it's it was impossible to get for the police to get through there with what they were trying to blast through the speakers. The people in the front couldn't hear. So then what you have is you have people, Black Bloc and possibly anarchists that are trying to stop police from moving to the front of the march. So what I see when I'm in the middle of the march is I see a bunch of people in masks trying to usher children, dogs and stuff out of this march because they can tell that police are becoming increasingly violent. And so, you know, it looks like on the news people set fires for no reason, just for destruction. That's not accurate. People set fires so that police couldn't march along and continue to hurt people along the march.
I don't know if you've seen the response from Ted Wheeler, but he, on a Facebook post today at least, commended the Portland Police Bureau for doing a tremendous job, is sure. A quote from him, what he said. Do you have anything to possibly respond to Ted Wheeler's statement that he made today?
Sure. I would ask why he didn't respond to people asking why the three minors that were arrested had their names put out. They understand and know that every single person whose name they put out, including myself, from protests, gets constant death threats, is doxxed immediately throughout their entire life. And they understand that. They've never once investigated any of the death threats against protesters, but they decided it was a great intimidation tactic to put out the names of these children that were arrested on false charges. So now those children are going to be getting death threats, and it's going to be harder for them to get a job. They might be in trouble in school. It might be hard when they try and go to college, all so that the police can prove a point and try and intimidate children from protesting. Again, there was also, you know, 20-something odd arrests, but only three of them were charged with rioting, and it's coincidentally the three minors. So, you know, I don't think police did an excellent job. They purposely are trying to intimidate children, and that's why they charged only the minors with rioting and released minors' name, which is not, you know, regular practice for the police department. They just did it in this case because they really hate protesters, and they're willing to put children's lives at risk just to prove their point. And I would ask, if one of these death threats actually happen, you know, hopefully it doesn't, but if it does, who are we going to say is responsible for that? Because there was no reason for the police department to be releasing their names. There's no reason for the police department to come to a permitted march in riot gear. There's no reason for the police department to be yanking a permit and hurting people indiscriminately, arresting people whose, obviously, their charges are not going to stick. So, no, and as long as this continues to happen, Ted Wheeler is going to continue to be protested, and I don't know how long it's going to take him to figure out that lesson. You know, people think he's a really bright guy, and I believe he's probably a bright guy, but I don't know why he keeps making the same mistakes over and over again, unless he's only trying to impress his donors rather than citizens who are sick of seeing police violence happen at protests. If there were no police at that May Day protest at all, especially, or at a minimum, no police in riot gear, you would have seen none of the violence that occurred.
You know, Ted Wheeler ran his campaign frequently talking about how he would be at the forefront of police reform here in the city after we went through all those years of Mayor Hales. I'm wondering, as somebody who has had to interact with both of these administrations and see the result of their policies around policing, do you see a difference between Charlie Hales and Mayor Wheeler so far?
Yes, I didn't think it could get much worse, but Ted Wheeler is far worse on protesting. And, you know, it's hard for me to say if it's coming directly from him or he's taking more of a hands-off approach and allowing the police to have more free rein to do as they wish. So I'm not sure if he's directing the violence, but yes, it's far worse. And it's going to continue to only get worse if we have police continue to show up in riot gear and hurt innocent people. So, you know, and yeah, he ran on this, and, you know, obviously most people think that he has ambitions far above from being mayor, but maybe at a minimum he might want to be reelected to mayor, and all that is gone now. I mean, he can't be reelected. He's going to have every activist in the city campaigning against him, and, you know, whatever race that he wants to go forth after being mayor is going to be far more difficult, because now he's known. This is what has plagued his administration, is him either being silent on police violence or encouraging police violence. And, you know, it might impress the business owners that donate to him, but they only get one vote, and every single person that he's beating up every time there's a protest get votes as well.
when I was looking at what's happening at the May Day rally yesterday and the police response, it really made me think about the police unions and their role and how much authority the police are given. And I kind of been wondering about the relationship between the union and the mayor's office. And I'm just sort of wondering if when you were witnessing everything that was happening yesterday, did the police unions come to mind by any chance?
It did, you know, and it's so ironic that on May Day, the police have the authority to beat up these workers and union members and to beat up these people because their union is so strong. So it's incredibly ironic. I'm obviously pro-union, but the police union is the worst of those. And, you know, if they don't hold themselves accountable and they're all into power, they're the only union that has the ability to indiscriminately go out and hurt people. And they don't believe that they ever do anything wrong. I've had officers tell me, look, we didn't agree with what happened. And I say, well, then you should either resign or speak out about it. And they don't have a culture right now that can do that. Ted Wheeler ran on transparency of the police department. We've seen none of that. We see scandal after scandal. Literally every week a scandal comes out about the police department. And it seems like they're, you know, taking advantage of Ted Wheeler, or Ted Wheeler just doesn't care because they are, you know, worse than ever right now, and certainly worse than under Charlie Hales, which is awkward for somebody who ran on police transparency.
We're kind of running out of time here, but as someone who I'm assuming you will continue to organize around here in the city of Portland, do you have hope that there is space, especially for marginalized communities, to voice their objections? Is it possible to create an environment where it is safe for marginalized people to protest in this city?
Yeah, it's going to take either continued protests of Ted Wheeler until he gets the message that this is not an effective way for him to remain mayor after this term, or to have, you know, a successful reign as mayor, or it's going to take him getting voted out of office, I think, you know. But at the end of the day, it's going to take riot police not being sent to peaceful protests, and it's also going to take, if one person does something that the state has deemed as illegal, that you don't take away everybody's First Amendment rights because of that one person. If I took that line with the Second Amendment, that there was a murder last night, so thus I want to kick everybody's door in and tear gas them and pepper spray them to take away everybody's Second Amendment right because one person messed up last night, people would be up in arms, literally. So it doesn't make sense that we take that line for the First Amendment, that because one or two or three individuals are accused of a crime, that we're going to shut down everybody's First Amendment rights. It's disgusting, it's unconstitutional, and it's just wrong for our mayor to be doing. And he's not representing the people of Portland. The people of Portland want to be able to protest. And in the wake of Donald Trump's presidency, we need to be expanding our rights to protest, not restricting them, because it could be Roe v. Wade that gets overturned, you know, next. And when women come out to protest, when the community comes out to protest, Ted Wheeler's going to already set a standard of gassing peaceful protesters.
That was Gregory McKelvey, organizer of Portland's Resistance. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenny Okuyama.
It's been intense for the last few days here in Bridge City. So to help soothe everyone's ears, here's the sound of a flowing creek to ease life's anxieties.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Transpositive PDX at 6 At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather. Finally, the rain will go away and we'll have a high temperature of 81 degrees, dropping to 51 overnight. East of the Cascades in Bend, expect clear skies and a high of 77. Today in history, Nelson Mandela was elected president of South Africa in the nation's first multiracial election. Today's quote is also from Mandela, who said, quote, "A good leader can engage in a debate frankly and thoroughly, knowing that at the end, he and the other side must be closer and thus emerge stronger. You don't have that idea when you are arrogant, superficial, and uninformed," end quote.
It's 5:25, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In addition to news, which involves reporting on real stuff, there's now fake news, stuff that's completely made up. But wait, the barons of corporate news are also adding to today's tumultuous state of journalism by putting out BS news, stuff they know is untrue but is reported because it advances their owner's political agenda. For example, The Washington Post, owned by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who's a laissez-faireland promoter of privatizing government functions, keeps publishing a load of BS to denigrate our post offices. In an alarmist editorial, the paper declared, "The U.S. Postal Service continues to hemorrhage red ink." Embracing Bezos' privatization ideology, the editors grumped that postal unions have made our mail service outmoded and insolvent, running up, quote, "a net loss of $5.6 billion last year." That is pure bovine excrement, and the editors know it. In fact, thanks to innovative and efficient postal workers, the mail agency racked up a $610 million operating profit last year and a $1.2 billion profit the year before. The $5 billion in red ink that the paper's propagandists pointed to is nothing but a bookkeeping hoax created by Congress to make people believe our post office is a hopeless money loser that must be privatized. In 2006, Congress manufactured an artificial loss for the Postal Service by decreeing that it pre-fund the health care costs of future retirees 75 years in advance. That includes retirees who are not even born yet. No other agency and no corporation, including Amazon, could survive if Congress added a $5 billion a year fictitious loss to their books. This is Jim Hightower saying, yet, in a shameful piece of BS journalism, the Washington Post intentionally ignored the true story.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The Sierra Club has a campaign to shut down coal plants. Here's a report from our friends at Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
Wherever you live in this country, there are decisions being made right now about where your electricity will come from, and those are decisions that need your voice.
That's Marianne Hitt, director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. The campaign works at the grassroots level to accelerate the transition to clean energy.
It's important to remember that most of the decisions about how we get our electricity are not made in Washington, D.C. They are made at the state level and the local level by state regulators, utility commissions, utilities themselves.
The Beyond Coal campaign helps concerned community members get a seat at the table to weigh in when local decisions are made. For example, when a new coal-burning power plant is proposed, permits are required, and this is an opportunity for the public to intervene. The approach is working. Together with other groups, HIT says the campaign has stopped more than 180 new coal power plants from being built and put about half the nation's existing coal plants on track to retire.
This unsung grassroots movement has created a sea change in how we make electricity in America.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Today, four groups filed suit against the Bureau of Land Management and the National Forest Service to halt plans for fracking in Ohio's only national forest. The Wayne National Forest is located in the hills of southeastern Ohio, next to the Ohio River, and was the site of a 3.0 magnitude earthquake last month that many believe was caused by fracking operations in the area. The lawsuit, brought by the Center for Biological Diversity, Ohio Environmental Council, Heartwood, and the Sierra Club, is seeking to block leases sold by the BLM to oil and gas companies who plan to expand fracking in the forest. There has been no environmental impact study on the effects of fracking in the area, which the conservation groups insist is a violation of the National Environmental Policy Act. Fracking in the area could also compromise the water quality in the Ohio and Little Muskingum rivers, which provide drinking water to millions of people downstream. Pollution from fracking could prove disastrous to those who rely on these rivers as a water source. The Ohio Oil and Gas Association argued on their website that fracking does not harm groundwater and that increased use of natural gas actually reduces air pollution. Studies throughout the history of humankind have proven that both air and water are necessary to support life.
Did you pull out your lawnmower this last weekend? If you're lucky enough to have your lawn on a lakefront, you might want to put the lawnmower away. From CurrentCast, the Center for Transformative Action has more.
Less lawn, more native landscaping for our lakes. On today's CurrentCast. You might like the look of a clean-cut lawn, but if you have lakefront property, experts say not to mow all the way to the shoreline.
The most important thing you can do for your lake is to create a buffer zone. And this is a patch of native plants along the lakeshore.
That's landscape architect Fred Rosamulski. He says even modest buffers can trap pollutants such as fertilizers and loose soils before they reach a lake. While the roots of a plant in a buffer zone prevent erosion, the flowers and branches provide valuable habitat for wildlife. And these buffers don't need to keep people away. Grass paths can provide eco-friendly access to the lake. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
Donald Trump has invited conservative leaders to the White House this Thursday to witness the signing of an executive order that would allow extensive religious objections by business and singular individuals and is expected to result in discrimination against the LGBT community. Senior administration officials have confirmed the planned meeting. However, the language of the order, termed the Religious Liberty Order, has yet to be finalized. Vice President Mike Pence and his team have been working on the final draft. The order uses a very broad definition of what a religious organization is and protects what is termed as religious freedom to any organization or person when providing social services, education, or health care, earning a living, seeking a job, or employing others. This gives protection from anti-discrimination laws to anyone who claims religious or moral objections to same-sex marriage, premarital sex, abortion, and trans identity, and it seeks to curtail women's access to contraception and abortion through the Affordable Care Act. The ACLU has issued a press release stating that if Trump signs an order allowing discrimination against women or LGBT people, they will see them in court.
An African-American boy was killed by police over the weekend in a Dallas, Texas suburb. 15-year-old Jonathan Edwards was sitting in the passenger seat of a vehicle that was leaving a party when he was shot in the head by a police officer. Initial reports claimed that the car Edwards was in was aggressively driving towards the police officer when the officer fired multiple shots into the vehicle. However, Police Chief Jonathan Haber has since corrected the initial claims after watching body camera footage, which shows that the car was actually driving away from police officers. An attorney for the Edwards family praised the police department for its transparency, but asked for authorities to do more.
On April 21st, U.S. Army paratroopers assigned to the 1st Battalion, 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment, and 3rd Brigade Combat Team, 82nd Airborne Division, tested their invasion skills during a combined arms live fire exercise at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. A spokesman for the paratroopers said that they were practicing with air support in order to be able to mobilize a vast force within 8 hours of a call-up. The Delta Special Forces Assault Platoon was also present with Apache assault helicopters, armed Humvees, and other equipment. 13 companies were brought together with their support groups to the massive practice brigade. In separate exercises, soldiers practiced taking civilians out of a live-fire urban situation. Several of the Marine Corps' vertical takeoff and landing airplanes, the MV-22 Ospreys, have flown to Darwin Air Base in Australia from their posts in Hawaii, completing the first trans-Pacific flight for the aircraft. The deployment brings them much closer to the Korean theater. Today, two B-1B Lancer stealth bombers practiced air refueling, necessary for long-range missions, in South Korean airspace. Lieutenant Colonel Lori Hodge, spokesperson for Pacific Air Command, wrote in an article on military.com that the exercises were conducted in conjunction with South Korean and Japanese armed forces. Meanwhile, drivers on a major east-west highway said that a 750-truck convoy of military supplies was heading west, moving toward Fort Lewis in Washington for Asian deployment. The equipment includes armored personnel carriers, tanks, wreckers, forklifts, assault vehicles, cargo boxes, and military Humvee transports. A trucker in the convoy said that the drivers were instructed not to talk about the massive war materials movement.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017. Former political detainee dies of health complications. Meanwhile, a Palestinian civilian injured by Israeli troops in various West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A former Palestinian political prisoner who joined the supporters of hunger-striking detainees at a solidarity tent died on Tuesday of a heart attack just 5 months after his release from prison. While in Israeli army detention, Mazen al-Mughrabi, 45, was subjected to medical negligence, leading to severe deterioration of his health, including kidney failure. The head of the detainee committee, Isa Karaka, stated that al-Mughrabi suffered from a heart attack and was rushed to Ramallah General Hospital, where he was pronounced dead around at dawn. The deceased was from Abawin village north of Ramallah in the central part of the occupied West Bank. The protest tent where al-Mughrabi suffered a heart attack was established to maintain a constant presence in solidarity with the hundreds of hunger-striking Palestinian political prisoners held by Israel. There are more than 1,500 Palestinians currently on hunger strike, and the number is increasing daily. The political prisoners are calling for a number of demands to be met, including medical treatment for prisoners, allowing visits from their families, and ending the so-called administrative detention in which Palestinians are held without charges for extended periods of months and years. In other news, a Palestinian civilian was injured. Many others suffered the severe effects of tear gas inhalation on Tuesday evening as Israeli troops invaded Kasra village in Yarnablus in northern West Bank. Local sources said that Israeli troops invaded the village and searched homes, which led to clashes between the invading forces and local youth who hurled stones at soldiers. Troops responded by firing tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. One civilian was injured in the leg by a rubber-coated steel bullet, medical sources reported. On Tuesday at dawn, a homemade explosive was hurled at an Israeli military jeep near Qalqilia city in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, causing damage but no injuries. The Israeli army said that several shots were also fired at the military jeep after the explosive object was thrown at it near the annexation wall close to Qalqilia city. The army added that the soldiers fired many live rounds at the area where the explosive was thrown from, while one Palestinian fired back and fled to Qalqilia. And that's all for today from DIMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017 News Roundup from the Occupied Palestinian Territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Khan, Ricky King, Tom Flynn, and Teresa Mitchell. Special thanks to Labor Radio and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jasmine.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Wednesday Talk Radio, News and Commentary with Paul Rowland. At 9, on The Politics of Living, One Woman's Journey Navigating the ACA While Fighting Cancer. Then author Wendy Sachs talks about how women thrive after changing careers. At 10, Chris Andrea hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show looks at cycling and transportation and how they affect our everyday lives. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member yet, you can become one by going to KBOO FM and clicking on Donate. Good night, Jasmine.
Night, Tom.
Good night, Wes.
Night, Wes.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hello, KBOO listeners. Welcome to another segment of News In Depth, which includes pieces that focus on local, national, or international issues that reflect KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, or social change. My name is Jesse Damon, and I am joined in the studio today by two guests. First is Christine Dupree, a writer, teacher, and citizen of the Cowlitz tribe. Second, I have Kathleen Holt, associate director and editor of Oregon Humanities, which is the independent nonprofit affiliate of the National Endowment of the Humanities. Welcome, ladies, to KBOO.
Thanks for having us.
Hey there.
Hi. Today, we're here to discuss a new online multimedia project created by Oregon Humanities titled This Land. And Kathleen, could you give our listeners a little information about the project?
Sure. As you said, it's an online multimedia project, so it lives on a website attached to Oregon Humanities' website. And what it really is a project that tries to explore connections between race, power, place, land, home, and belonging. And in a state like Oregon, these are very live issues and questions that many of us are grappling with every day. In our past experience in trying to convene conversations around race, power, and place, we realized that there were just so few stories told by Oregon artists of color. This is a place where filmmakers, photographers, and writers and sound artists and data illustrators can all come together to really explore what have been the policy and historical connections that create the conditions that we see in our state today. So when folks are wondering why gentrification has happened in particular communities and affected particular populations, or why home ownership levels for particular groups are so low, we can actually point back to exclusionary practices, policies that have created those inequities that now we see today. That's kind of boring, frankly, to just talk about policy. But what isn't boring is to hear artists whose communities have been affected by these policies tell those stories in beautiful, poignant, sometimes quite heartbreaking ways.
Why did Oregon Humanities choose to make it a multimedia project rather than a one format, rather than just having filmmakers or writers or illustrators just contribute?
One of the things our organization has been pretty good at doing for many years is collecting stories in our magazine that are written, so essays. There's certainly power to those stories. When we started working with filmmakers about 3 or 4 years ago, we started seeing a really different relationship that we were having with people who participated in our programs. For one, the print form in a magazine has limited distribution, online, much wider distribution. But then when you think about how people share information and stories, it's often a kind of a combination. Very often it's film and it's sound pieces, so podcasts. So we had some pretty good success with a film that we produced with Ifani Bell a few years back called Future Portland, which really looked at the effects of gentrification in North Portland and the Black community there. The response to that was kind of amazing. It was a national response. A lot of the Washington Post picked it up. The Atlantic picked it up. And it just seemed to help bring a conversation together that had been happening in small ways. And it also did so, because it was visual, in an emotional way. And the voices that you were able to hear and the faces you were able to see really made you realize the people who were affected. I think that made us realize the power of the visual image. Mm. And so we expanded it into that realm.
Amazing. And so what does Oregon Humanities hope to achieve by this project?
There's a couple of things. I mean, we're pretty committed to ensuring that all kinds of voices are present in all of our works. And that is in our public programs as well as in our publications. And we don't think there are that many platforms, frankly, that offer that. There's also, going back to kind of the more boring policy side, there's also a way that we felt that there's systems of inequity that exist. They seem invisible. They may be invisible to most people who don't have to deal with them every day. But what we felt that this project could do is sort of show at least the outlines of that system and really kind of tie back to some of the policies. The idea was we wanted it to be more hopeful, because even though the system seems really big and impossible to budge, these policies and legislation, they were put in place by people. And so that means they can be changed by people. And we really wanted to offer a place to see that bigger picture and to offer those voices to the community.
And speaking of policy and reaching the community, Christine, you and I were able to work on a project together and collaborate, and we created a contribution that we titled Earth on Fire. And why don't you give a little brief on what our project looked like and how we were able to contribute to the This Land project?
Well, I want to start out by thanking you, Jesse, Juan, and Kathleen, because one of the things that got to happen is we were able to meet in this project. You're a sound artist, I'm a writer, and our project looked at fire in 2015, mega fire in 2015 in Oregon. It began to refine itself as I thought about the Warm Springs tribe, its firefighting efforts, policies of fire suppression, and what that means to sacred foods like the huckleberry, right? And from there, I would say it was a process of discovery with you. We met Yolanda Yollop, a young woman who's a firefighter at Warm Springs, and began to put together both a narrative of how the policy of fire suppression has impacted the land, in this case, Warm Springs on the dry side, and what tribes who have long been advocates for the land are doing, right, to renew sacred foods, to protect the land, to fight fires. And I'm going to hand it to you because it's easy enough to write about those things or to interview someone. And Yolanda was a fascinating young woman from Warm Springs, from a whole family of firefighters. Her mother, I think maybe her grandmother, though I'd have to double check, and then her sister all fight fires at Warm Springs. And Yolanda happened to be in Portland at the time. But I wonder, kind of passing this back to you, how did you start to think about sound as being able to embed itself in this project?
Oh, so I guess with learning about the impact that the mega fires had in 2015 brought to mind visually what that would look like. Just hearing your descriptions, Christine, about the horses, the wild horses just running frantic, the brush just being engulfed in flames, the wind, the overpowering wind, and the sense that there weren't enough people to contain it. And so it just became so overwhelming and became this mega fire. And throughout this process, I learned that there were actual policies in place that tribes grew through tradition to actually maintain some of the underbrush, to maintain the actual landscape of their land, to control these fires so that they did not become these mega fires.
Right. Tribes have in the area have right. burnt, right? So that the huckleberries could emerge, so that there was Correct. A reliable harvest.
Yeah. And so that was fascinating for me to draw into that emotion, but to create an audible experience so people can understand a little bit more about what the native peoples were experiencing from their perspective, and to actually bring to light the actual importance of some of these fire policies and how it actually can preserve some of the natural resources that these tribes rely upon. Mm-hmm. And so that was something for me, just learning about the history and the importance of all of the landscape and the importance of actual land, you know, that's their home. And so seeing that, knowing that if it was my home, I would also feel that sense of wanting to protect it as much as possible. And so trying to create that space in an audible setting was a big challenge for me, but it was also a learning experience that I definitely enjoyed going through. And to speak with you, Christine, and to learn about Yolanda's story, but also incorporating a local musician, a singer-songwriter named Kelly Bosworth, who just is a beautiful guitar player, and be able to incorporate sound effects and music and things like that to tell the story of these mega fires was just a really amazing experience for me. And so I want to play just a short little clip that you can hear from our piece, Earth on Fire, and then we'll come back and talk about more about the project for this land.
To watch them burn, in fact, a whole bunch of dry side Pacific Northwest Indian country burn, and know that there were not enough souls around to stop it. To hear about the horses running frantic and wild, hear the coyotes howling at every hour, the owls talking to each other, to feel the suffering, to breathe it in and phlegm it out, it was too much.
All right, so that was a clip from the piece that Christine and I contributed for the This Land Project. Our piece was titled Earth on Fire. And Kathleen, where can our listeners go to actually hear the project and watch the films that were created for This Land?
So it's at our website. So it's OregonHumanities.org. And this land is one of the pull-down options. You can also search for it on the site. And right now we have four stories posted. We have some films, that audio piece, and some essays.
Wonderful. And if listeners want to get involved in Oregon Humanities or just find out more information of other events that you're putting on, where can they go? Or do you have any upcoming events that they can join?
Yeah, the website's a good source for that. We have a calendar, and you can sort by the county that you live in. But coming up, one thing that we did with this land was we layered it on top of a public program that we do in the Portland area called Think and Drink. And we used, in two cases, we'll do it ultimately in three cases, a film to start the conversation on stage. And so on May 17th, at the Alberta Rose, we're going to be premiering another film about East Portland, and we're going to be having a conversation about sort of creative and innovative ways to deal with wealth and land inequity.
Wonderful. And just one final thought I want to get from both of you, just how you felt the project came together as a whole. I know for me, it was amazing learning experience just to hear about the different communities of color that made Oregon what it is today and the history behind it that a lot of people did not know about. And so bringing to light some of those historical moments was really impactful for me, knowing that I'm not a native Oregonian, but I learned so much from these people and from these stories. And so I hope with the This Land Project that more listeners and more people can be more aware and more up to date on where Oregon came from, you know, the history behind it. And so I was just curious for each of you ladies what you felt just overall about the project.
Well, I love that there was an experience available to artists of color to cooperate and then to float and emerge narratives that get suppressed historically. Both those things are so exciting to me. And I think that's it. There's lots more, but I'm going to stop there.
Yeah, I myself, I'm a person of color, and I identify as a writer as well. For me, it's been really comforting to work collaboratively with so many artists across the state on this project and to feel that passion and energy and that desire to work on something beautiful and put it out into the world, even when it comes from something that's quite painful. And it's also been an incredible learning experience for me as well, to learn that collaboration is very difficult and that artists work very, very hard to get their voice just right. So these are all things that have been really wonderful for me. And watching everything start to fill the site, it is really doing that interconnectedness that we had hoped it would do.
Great. Well, Christine Dupree, writer, teacher, and citizen of the Cowlitz Tribe, and Kathleen Holt, associate director and editor of Oregon Humanities, thank you both for joining me in the studio today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And this has been Jesse Damon for KBOO News In Depth.
We have this monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. We call it KBOO at the Clinton. This month's film is Plant This Movie. It screens on Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. Plant This Movie explores the zeitgeist of urban farming from around the world, from Havana to Shanghai, from New Orleans to Portland, Oregon. The filmmaker will be present. Again, that's Plant This, Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
The time is 5:58 and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Waiting for, and my time was running wild in me in dead end streets. And every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Hey, good evening. This is Gene Bryant, and this is the Transpositive PDX Hour. This evening, we are continuing a series that we started last month featuring family and friends of trans folks and sharing their stories. So this evening we have two pre-recorded interviews, both of them with spouses of trans folks, both of them coming from slightly different perspectives. And we will take a little break in the middle, and then we will also do a little bit of discussion and close out when we get to the end of them. So with that, we'll just go straight to the first interview, which is with a woman who was the spouse of a trans woman who transitioned late in her life. So with that, we'll just go to the interview. Thank you. This is for the friends and family segments of Transpositive PDX radio show. We're in studio with a spouse of a trans person, and the purpose of these interviews is to capture their stories. They go through